Mormon Matters Podcast is a production of the Open Stories Foundation and is seeking to build financial support separate from Mormon Stories Podcast. All donations to Mormon Matters are fully tax deductible and go directly towards keeping the podcast alive and towards building a community of support for Mormons like you. To support the podcast or to join the community, please become a monthly subscriber today at mormonmatters.org.
So stage four, Fowler calls individuative and reflective. And so those terms, we'll try to unpack them as go individuative, kind of more at the individual level. You're starting to think of yourself separate from groups and being a little more conscious about, you know, your choices. And reflective is, again, you're reflecting now on your story as a story. You're now the fish, or you're now out of the water, reflecting on the qualities of water rather than just purely swimming in it. So starting at age in the early 20s or something towards the end of life is where most of the people, you know, there's tons of people that he mapped here, and it was another 40% of his total survey sample that he had here at stage four, or in the stage three to stage four, moving into that transition. So it's a very common thing. And here's one of the things that happened that he says that, and this is where I think a lot of people who are listening to this podcast are going to go, dang it, I've got the harder road to hoe here. Because he says, ideally, stage four really starts to happen when you have a shift. You leave home and go to college. You get into the military. You are somehow, you know, either physically or emotionally or within your brain, you have now begun to experience a different home. It's ideal if it occurs in your 20s or 30s, because that's before you've established relationships that were sort of built around a stage three, you know, like say you got married or something, and you developed this whole life vision of yourselves from this earlier model, and now you're moving into a new model. It can be very difficult if both of you aren't kind of moving together or something like this.
Plus your age cohort are moving through that too, and so that when you come to it later, which I think many Mormons do, because the underlying primary church message is still
yes,
in that
right.
previous stage. They're elements. It's a mixed model. They're elements of this stage, certainly. But they're also the center of gravity for many people is at that stage. And so therefore, if you don't move through it, then I think there's a later onset.
Yeah.
I know there
yes.
was for me. I reached that stage in my 30s. And it was then, at that point, it really truly was a huge crisis with attendant panic attacks and distressed and all. Anyway, I don't need to go into that at the moment, but
Well, one of the things he talks about, in this one he tells a story of a guy who was, you know, in this, you know, it's a really interesting personal journey that he kind of illustrates this stage with. But one of the things that kind of reminded me, there was a section there where he's talking about, and here's what Mormonism does, and he says lots of groups do this. As children go away to college or something like that, where they might meet diverse and interesting people and really begin to say, whoa, holy smokes, this person puts the world together completely different than me. They look to other things for their authority than I do. And man, how can I really fault them for it? How can I really say that my way is better or worse? And that's, you know, that's a pretty normal, healthy thing for you to say, man, I have to choose myself, you know, what I believe. Because you see this, if you get, you know, if you're in the religious education program, if you go to institute, and if you only hang out with other Mormon kids in that environment, you know, the dating pool is only other Mormons or whatever like this. And not that these are bad things. I mean, my daughter's an institute. I'm glad that she's an institute, you know, kind of thing. But this can kind of hurt you from forming these other relationships to really ask the big questions, because you know, you're still swimming in that. So even as you're transitioning and you maybe And here's kind of what happened with me. I would let my mind go crazy with, Plato versus Aristotle versus Nietzsche versus Kant. But I wasn't really going there with religion. You know what I mean? With my own personal religion there when I was right. When I was at the first part of Arizona State, I really wasn't letting other theories kind of affect my faith. And that's because I...
But you were practicing the process of doing it so that when it came to reflecting on your faith, you already had some, as it were, language skills to
exactly.
do so. So you could go through that other stage maybe faster about your, that stage, excuse me, faster about religious faith because you'd already practiced the skills of perspective taking, multiple perspective taking.
Nice. Thank you. That's very, very helpful. And I'll let you know, too, I also was benefited greatly by finding a mentor, you know. Yeah. Because once this did happen and it did feel like a crash and a burn, and I seriously, you guys, I've been carrying about 100 extra pounds around for quite a few years. I'm let everybody know I've lost 25 pounds this year, so I'm on the way working through
great.
This. But I gained 60 pounds in 6 months.
Wow.
It was that big a crisis for me.
I couldn't
make sense. But then I found Randy Paul, you know, just the, kind of another one of these miraculous when I needed it most, a person came into my life. And, you know, again, at first you're still letting other people kind of be authoritative figures for him, but just his enthusiasm for me on this journey was so important for me to say, okay, I have permission to go here. I'm in safe territory because, you know, here Randy's 13 years older than me, and, you know, and there was no sense from him that he's higher or lower. He just had done it ahead of me. You know what I mean? And so when you can find a mentor, and I know that sometimes these podcasts even kind of serve that way for a lot of you, and I hope that you get face-to-face mentors and you know, you reach out to those of us who you are looking to kind of be there, because it's very, very important. So I appreciate what you said, Mary Beth, and I hadn't intended to say that, but the idea that you're doing perspective taking in other parts of your life prepares you for religion. That was a great comment. I hadn't quite a thought of that. So thank you. Okay, so what's happening here is you have a real interruption in your life. The tyranny of the they is becoming weakened. In other words, you've begun to, like I say, individuative is one of his phrases for this phrase. You begin to say, okay, I've got to take responsibility for myself. And so one of the things that he talks about here is the emergence of what is called the executive ego. I don't know if that's his own term or something. When you think of an executive council that, you know, you put problems or something in front of them and they weigh things out and stuff like this, he kind of says within your own mind, you begin to sort of submit everything to, like, oh, how does that sit with me? You know, why am I having such a visceral reaction to this? And you begin to go inside and you say, oh, what's going on? Maybe I don't really believe that, or you know, or you're, you know, I'm left cold by this, but I'm really excited by this. And you begin to really start to say, what is life teaching me, and how do I, you know, how do I own it myself?
So
in terms of
Jenny Wade and talking about level of brain function, this is when the front brain or the executive functions of the brain that are come forth, because the neocortex front brain is starting to practice, starting to grow up, starting to make a lot of more connections, and then gradually as that gets stronger and stronger, the neocortex gradually trains the limbic system to, much like training a puppy or whatever, to come along and to either soothe or to be calm or to be open. Anyway, so when it's the executive ego, it's direct reference to the executive functions in the brain are starting to mature. There's actual brain growth in terms of a vast amount of new pathways and neuronal connections.
Awesome.
Wow.
I just love how that integrates. This stuff is really fascinating stuff to me. Okay, so he kind of says that there's two things that when it happens healthily in stage four, there's two moves to sort of be made. He says the two essential features of the emergence of stage four are, one, critical distancing from one's previous assumptive value system, and two, the emergence of the executive ego. When these occur, a person is forming a new identity, which he or she expresses and actualizes by the choice of personal and group affiliations and the shaping of what he calls, quote-unquote, a lifestyle. But then he says, what can happen is some people only do one half of this and not both.
They'll
complete half of this double move and not complete the other. So, for instance, he says, by virtue of the college experience, travel, or being moved from one community to another, many persons undergo the relativization of their inherited worldview and value systems. They come face to face with the relativity of their perspectives and those of others to their life experience, but they fail to interrupt the reliance on external sources of authority, and they may even strengthen their reliance upon them in order to cope with this relativity. So this is that idea of, you know, I now see that mine is an assumptive value system or whatnot, but this is a scary world that I'm meeting here with. Who knows what's right? Who knows what's wrong? Up and down, topsy-turvy. And so we might double down a little bit on our previous stuff to negotiate that.
So an example of this moving to the relativity and seeing the diversity, which the church has been emphasizing a lot. An example of this is Dieter Uchtdorf's 2013 October conference talk. And I think the name of it is coming to me, but essentially that's the famous, the doubt your doubts speech.
So right.
So he's saying people leave. People leave for reasons. People come for different reasons. We want all of you here. So he's saying the relativity occurs, diversity occurs. But then he emphasizes, stay true to the form, stay true to your authorities, stay, doubt your doubts, be with us. So that speech is a great example of what you're talking about.
Nice.
Yeah,
very
really.
Cool. So, you know, this doubling down here because you haven't done both halves of this. And so the other half he talks about is for people who get a strong executive ego, but then don't do the distancing. So here he says, on the other hand, there is a significant group who shape their own variant way of living from a shared value ethos. They break their reliance on consensual or conventional authorities, and they begin to show the emergence of a strong executive ego, but they have not carried through the critical distancing from their shared assumptive value systems. And then he talks about, you know, the problems with this. So in other words, they, you know, I'm now choosing for myself, but I'm now choosing still within my worldview. And I haven't begun to relativize my worldview from others, though I'm within my worldview. I'm now taking a strong ownership. Did I make any sense there?
Okay.
And so these things, both things need to happen to kind of really get you there. So critical questioning becomes important here. Demythologizing. So we had these stories, and now all of a sudden we recognize them as stories. And in some ways, when you recognize something as a story, it kind of loses some of its power. Same thing with a symbol. There's this one of the little personal things here. He says, Harvey Cox is a famous theologian at Harvard, talks about one of his students talking about he's not really Christian himself, but he had a Christian girlfriend. She was a year ahead of him, so when he's a senior in high school, she had gone off to college, and he had always enjoyed going to these Christian mass and whatnot with her. And this time, as they're at this Christmas mass, she turns to him, and she had taken anthropology 101, and she says, and she turns to this boy and says, "You know, that's just a primitive totemic ritual." He goes,
oh,
what? What? She goes, a primitive totemic ritual. Almost all pre-modern religions and tribal groups have them. They're ceremonies where worshippers bind themselves together into the power of the sacred by a cannibalistic act of ingesting the mana of a dead god.
And so
here's in this moment this guy, this beautiful thing, and because she had gotten a little bit of knowledge and she had tied it to her own Catholic, you know, Eucharist sort of thing, this is kind of ruins and takes him out of the moment. And so Cox says, communion was never the same again. A symbol recognized as a symbol is a broken symbol. And that's what can happen, and it's natural, and it's important to recognize the symbol separate from what it's pointing to. But he says there's the danger here of, you know, completely devaluing it, completely dismissing it. Oh, it's like, I don't want to be like one of those pre-modern peoples. You know, I don't want to, you know, be associated by anybody around me or even in my own heart with something so elementary. And so you begin to kind of reject instead of, you know, hold them there. Another term he uses for what happens with symbols here is they become flattened. Comparisons right. of meanings become more easily possible, though a certain tendency to reductionism and the flattening of meanings is difficult to avoid. So it's important to have these reflections. Individuative reflective is the name of this stage, to kind of see what's happening there. But, you know, be aware.
Let me interject in terms of developmental stages of relationships. So when I was in graduate school, I had a wonderful professor who described this stage. And you move from the romance stage to the disillusionment stage. And he said the real goal is of this stage for couples is to become disillusioned, to look through your illusions, to see them. So to become disillusioned but never become disenchanted. You find ways to keep the enchantment, the real rituals that bring you into the enchantment, but also then see through a glass more, or see more clearly.
Very good. Oh, I love that. Okay, I'm going to say there's a stop there. There was one term I do like that I think he picks it up from Paul Ricoeur. I'm not looking at the book itself to do this, but he says, and it was kind of hinted at it before when he talked about the people who complete one half of another. Because of the fearfulness of stage four, because of the topsy-turviness and everything is up for grabs and whatnot, he says that some people will exercise what Ricoeur called a willed naivete. So as an act of will, they will say, I am no longer going to think about these questions. I am just going to fully go back into my synthetic conventional, you know, thing as a choice. I am making this choice that my life was happier before, and that's where I'm going to live and center. And sort of this, you know, by willpower, they're able to do this.
Yeah, I'm going to close that door. I open the door. There be monsters. I'm going to back away.
Yes. But I'm guessing, Mary Beth, you'll have some stories to tell of sometimes you can only hold back life so long. You know, puny
right.
arms trying to stop the flow of the Mississippi River. Generally, you can only tamp down and, you know, pretty soon you get exhausted and things are going to come out. And so one of the real dangers of the will naivete movement is the explosion later.
Well, and it's most often triggered by trauma. If somebody really doesn't want to, then there's a big crisis such as cancer or a child dies or you get in an auto accident and you can't function as well anymore and so essentially you've got the external crisis at the same time the internal coming apart of that. And so you're not skilled enough to feel like, oh, I can differentiate between the two and handle this in a different way. It becomes, how do I? Anyway, that's generally what happens.
Yeah, and what you said there about a skill is so, so important here, because I can think of, and you guys with marriage and family that you are both, you know, alerted to or something, if one spouse is super dominant over the other and it's constantly, you know, I'm submitting, I'm underneath your thing, you haven't developed the skills of like, you know, hashing things out or talking openly about dynamics or whatnot. And this is where, like, you know, I can only eat shit for so long, and then boom, you know, things might explode later and you'll just all out of whack. You know, your response will be to pull out a gun or to, you know, murder them or to just, you know, I'm leaving you and the kids and I'm gone, you know, and it's because you haven't developed the skills to communicate. So anyway, so that's, you know, just know that it's out there and it happens. And, you know, if it's happened in your own life, just you're pretty normal. You've done things. We're always trying to find equilibrium and a balance, but life has a way of serving things up, like you said, Mary Beth, through crisis or whatever it is. And it, I don't think willed naivete is a good move. I don't think it's.
Well, but sometimes you don't know, you don't have any other capacity to do so. So it's not like, oh, I'm consciously not choosing this and not choosing the skills and not blah blah blah. It's like that's just too scary, and so you stop.
But it should be a temporary solution, and you've kind of trying to make permanently what something is maybe just protective in a good way. You end up
correct. However, it's really important to understand that a huge percentage of the population don't have an idea of developmental stages for adults. They don't know what's coming next. It feels like every stage is the end of the road, and if people talk about that beyond, it's not complex and literal enough to figure out how you develop that. And so the will naivete is the best solution at the time because they don't see anything ahead.
Right. Yeah,
that resonates. So that's why study of developmental stages early, even in high school, whatever, might be really important.
Yeah, to give people a sense for what's coming.
Correct. Yeah. And then it will keep coming through your entire life. There's a roadmap here, yes.
Right. Yes. Yes. And, you know, and that's kind of good. Tom Kimball is a very good friend of mine. And as we're about to talk about stage five, he said something quite interesting when we were talking with John. I talked about Randy Paul being 13 years older than me. I think I'm probably about that much older than Tom. And so I don't want to, like, you know, try to, you know, better, worse, you know, smarter, not as, you know, whatever it would be. I don't want anything to come across like this. But Tom was pretty open as I began to talk about stage five and my own experiences of orienting to the world and to beliefs and whatnot in kind of this different way. You know, Tom just goes, you know, Dan, that's just crazy talk to me. You know, I don't sense it. I can't even imagine to live in the world like you. I mean, it's either right or, you know, not that he's going straight black and white or things like this. He goes, this is what's been taught. This is how Mormonism has been presented to me. This is how the world's been presented to me. I know it's not that way, but I can't figure out how you are feeling super warm towards it, or why you will take all the harmful aspects of it and still say, well, that's not all of it. And it was just kind of this interesting dynamic with Tom and me. And John did a podcast maybe a year and a half ago. It was 6 years or so after our Tom and I did the Stages of Faith together to see where we were. And we didn't really revisit the stages. But, you know, Tom, in some ways, has he just moved on from Mormonism to, you know, Unitarian Universalist. And because it's a system that is much more open to lots of perspectives and things like that than Mormonism is. But anyway, synthetic conventional, the move to stage five, which Fowler calls the conjunctive stage, conjoining, was just something that, you almost have to experience it. And so by 1997, when I met Fowler on the plane, I'd finished my doctorate in 1996. I was looking for a job. That's why I was, in fact, going to the AAR, because they kind of do these, you know, everybody who's, you know, hiring that year kind of have these big cattle calls, and you get to interview, you know, people for 10 minutes or whatnot, and they decide whether they want to bring you to campus to continue on or not. But I was in stage four, absolutely, I was in stage four, but I had begun to have some stage five hints, sometimes through Randy Paul and just the calm and things like that. I get these PEAK, these peaks that way, or I mean the PEEK, excuse me, the peak ahead.
Yeah,
the peak of the peak, the EE right. of the EAK. And I began to have these sort of things. And so five, as Fowler began to describe this, like, oh yeah, I'm sensing this. I'm catching on to this. I'm feeling it. In fact, my dissertation was on sort of things within Mormonism that I really liked. So I'd just, you know, been immersed in that last, you know, few years on, you know, some of the more, to me, profounder, or, you know, things that should be at the table, you know, in the academic world, that people should know that Mormons have this interesting take on this, or and that kind of stuff. So I was in sort of this mode of, yeah, I see all the problems and I see all the negatives, but I was able to see it. But stage five began it hit me at in 1997 way, way differently than it had in 1988, because I'd begun to do this. So let's try to describe it. I apologize for all the extra here. So again, conjunctive with think of the word conjoin. A lot of times, as Fowler talks about, when people transition from stage four to stage five, they've done this demythologizing, they've done this sort of breaking apart of symbols, and, you know, they've begun to sense, man, the world is not vibrant anymore. It's kind of lost its meaning. You know, this is where the existential angst and whatnot can kind of do it, and, you know, little nihilism, and there's no true way to be an arbiter of this or that. It's all relativistic and whatnot. And you begin to do this, but he says sometimes when those seem to be ready to start to move on to stage five, they'll begin to recognize this and reflect upon this and say, wow, I long for something that I used to have. You begin to sense there's some aliveness again in what you used to feel, and it's attract. And he more than anything else, he says this kind of comes with age. There's things that just sort of happen when you're in your midlife there. And so I think he has mid-30s to end of life is before he really starts to see anybody map at stage five. And he says, you know, think of yourself here at midlife. You're not young. You're not old. More and more of your peers are dying. You begin to sit there and reflect on choices that you made that you cannot unmake. You know, I chose this career over that. Of course, lots of people do change careers and things like this. You know, I chose this spouse when I maybe had longed for that person or something like that. You begin to sort of see the roads traveled and not traveled. You begin to make peace and take a different perspective on your life. Sometimes he says the most important is your defeats. There's a phrase, I believe it's in this book, it might be in one of his other ones, the sacrament of defeat. You know, the things that have served us up that were the most painful things, but we begin to sort of sense that there was something holy.
Holy, or that we can extract learning from it. In terms of Jenny Wade and brain function, what starts to happen is that the front brain and executive functions are now fully mature. And then there starts to be what she calls an entrainment or a coordination between the right and left hemispheres. So essentially you're requiring 3D vision about things, whereas before you may have had one vision and, you know, double vision or, you know, coordinated both eyes. But you have 3D vision or even another dimension beyond. So you can, or multisystemic thinking. You can think of one system, then another system, and then your own where you were in the younger stages, and you can claim them and call them back home. Jenny Wade says that until you reach this stage, we have an allergic reaction to all stages that we've already gone through and diminished them, or to all of the stages we can grow into, and then we call it hocus pocus, or we get confused and we don't understand. So at
crazy talk, stage, yeah. That's what Tom's
saying. Yeah, at this stage, you can claim it all. You really can claim your inner diversity, even the painful stuff, as well as the outer.
Awesome. And you kind of just have to live, right?
You have to go through, because your brain in its own way starts to move through this direction. You can push the development by learning some things earlier if you have a map, for instance. That was what happened to me. Because I had a map by this time, when I really started moving to this stage, I could orient. I could kind of pull it up and look at that Google Earth and go, and here's what I should be doing. So I picked up a fairly consistent meditation practice, because I knew from reading Wilbur, reading meditation books and so on, that would help me stabilize the emotional roller coaster. It would help me stabilize perspective. It would open up perspective. And so that's been singularly one of the very best practices, although I do quite a few different meditation practices, kind of dabble here and there, but I have a system now. That was an enormous piece of helping me move into that, to move from having the PEEK experiences to feel like, okay, there you can acquire mastery into this, or you can acquire stability within it.
Yeah. And when you're in this sort of stage, he talks about, you know, you just see relationships and you see connections between things that were still sort of discursive, that were still, you know, sort of separated out, and your brain can kind of, you know, take over and say, you know, right or wrong on rational basis. And you start to say, man, the non-rational aspects of my life, where you start to own the fact that you make decisions for all sorts of deeper, this is what you guys in therapy untease, right? With people, there's all sorts of motivations other than just your brain, you know, and there, this is the kind of stuff that's coming alive here, and you're beginning to sense it. And so the world begins, and he uses some metaphors here for what the sense of stuff is. He says, imagine, you know, what you learned in physics, that light is both wave and particle. And that's, you know, it's impossible for them to be both, but yet it is. And you sort of accept that and you say, oh, depends on how I approach it. It will reveal itself this way or that way. And so lots of life becomes more open and able to, you're able to see that if I lean this way or if I orient this way, this is what's going to happen. He says the vision is sort of like looking at both through a microscope and a wide angle lens at the same time.
Right. You can zoom in and out.
Simple solutions start revealing surprising depth and richness. and say, wow, you know, the wait, like last time, Adam Miller was on the podcast. He did a really nice meditation on the wages of sin is death. You know, this Paul statement that a lot of us go, what the heck? You know, I'll make the connection from, oh, the wages of sin is death. That means spiritual death. That means cut off from the presence of God. And that's about as far as we take it. And, you know, the way Adam just like took us through that, you just go, holy smokes. Paul probably got it. You know, he really was onto something there. Another one of his phrases, discovering that your parents are remarkable people separate from the fact that they're your parents. You know, you just be able to enter into their life and their world and just to see it and you're not under their authority anymore kind of thing. You're more like that friend stage that I was talking about with Phil's thing with you and God. One
now,
of the things that...
If you go into a relationship focus, you have deeper empathy because you really can go in and inhabit their worldview, not just see it or I get it or I, you know, like in a reading a text worldview. You can feel it because Wilbur describes this very clearly, that when you start to integrate the emotional, the richness, even the spiritual experiences with the cognitive and the multiple perspective taking, he calls it transrational. He doesn't call it irrational or rational. He calls it transrational, those states of awareness and being that start to move you into transcendence. But you have a way to hold it. You have a way to really enjoy the richness of it, knowing you're not going to be experiencing it every moment. You can go back and look at all your different spiritual experiences, claim them all, and bring them all around the table, so to speak, and know that there's a wide variety you have experienced all your life, but you can claim each one and not diminish previous more young ones.
So good, so good. Also tied to my last podcast about stories, here's some phrases from Fowler that will sound familiar to those that listen to this. In this stage, you're more willing to let reality speak its word. Adam Miller's thing is actually live life. Life is going to present something to it, and you just simply let it teach you what it wants to teach you, rather than have your story say, I reject that portion of life, or, you know, somehow or other, you know, your lens is going to always impose meaning immediately upon that experience or what's being served up to you. So you're willing to let reality speak its word. Let it sit. We don't feel the need to impose meaning on it. Let it sit, be, wash over us, even if it challenges the previously things we held fast to and loved. We let reality drive our worldview. We let it tell us, drives our knowing rather than our theories driving what we allow to be as reality.
Right.
I don't know. Yeah, I hope that made some kind of sense. And then one of the things that I just love here is he's at this point, we are vulnerable to be converted to another's view, or at least to be envious of it. I've mentioned on this podcast through the years, there were just a couple of times that were, one was with process theology, one was with, you know, Whitehead and his thought. Another one was with Taoism for me, and just a deep immersion in both of these systems, to where I just like, I truly was able to enter in and see the beauty of what it looked like from inside those systems. And
yeah.
And I loved it, and they converted me, yet at the same time I still had my reasons for wanting to be a Mormon, you know.
It's like saying I've learned other languages, but I've decided I still want to talk. Excuse me, I still want to communicate primarily in English.
Yeah, exactly. And so there's this theorist called Lee Yearly, and he's at Stanford, and Randy Pollan and I, in the book that we're writing together, we use him, and he has this, he calls it the virtue of spiritual regret. So we have all heard of Kirsten Stendhal that says, you know, develop the idea of religious envy, or, you know, of spiritual envy of another religion.
Right.
With him, it's like spiritual regret is, he talks about his own experience of being immersed within Buddhism. I can't remember which country he had gone to, but he was within the culture of Buddhism, and he's, you know, come from a pretty mainline Christian background. It might even have been evangelical or something. And he's, you know, as he's driving on the boat, or as he's on the boat and the shore is fading from this country where he'd had this deep immersive experience, he says, I regretted that I could only have one life, that I could only live one life, you know. And he carried that with him. I'm, you know, in this case, I'll say I'm Mormon, but you know, I'm so much richer, and yet I'm tinged with sadness that I can't be both Mormon and fully Taoist or Mormon or it's just this remarkable thing. It's turned into, there's a lot of theoretical things that I've done with that, along with Randy a bit here and there. But anyway, that's another thing. Openness to paradox and contradictions. We're enlivened when we see something that doesn't totally add up. We're delighted by it instead of being just simply annoyed, you know, because it doesn't all fit into our little schema, you know. We recognize the archetypal meanings of things, that there's power sort of at this level that's operating below the surface. There's this deep sea that these things are floating upon, and there's all those kinds of things. We feel and we recognize our shadow selves. This is where you guys in your therapy would do a lot of work with. Every gift has shadows, and we're beginning to open and honor those within ourselves. We're open to the voices of our deeper self. And then with symbols become alive again. Now we see them as doorways. Now we see them as launching pads. Now we see them as moments or talismans or totems or something like that that give us time to reflect. You know, I've mentioned on this podcast before, when I read scriptures now, I no longer, you know, worry that, you know, this is conveying truth 100%, you know, it's like, obviously these are other people's experience with God and that they've got it wrong half the time, you know, or more than half, or who knows how, where my calculus
went. You're post-judgmental.
I'm post-judgmental on that, but they've become doorways for me. They become meditative, you know, tools. You know, these symbols are good. They stuck around for lots of years because they're good things to think about, whether or not they capture, you know, perfectly what's going on here. So this idea of symbols become doorways. Your willingness to reclaim and rework your own past, to make peace with it again. Carolyn Pearson, as she talked at the very first Mormon Stories conference and came, she just talked about the importance of those who've struggled with their religion and Mormonism, in this case, obviously, and who felt like they had to leave it. She says she read some theorist from her book, Circling the Wagons, but she read a section from there. It says, like, the most important thing you can do is de-trigger yourself to come to peace with all the yous that you used to be. You know what I mean? Because you'll just never move on happily with life. And so that's a stage 5 gift, is where you can rework your past.
Let me suggest a little ritual that people might do if they are at this, at stage 4, moving into stage 5 or stage at that, that if they are attending church, if they're going, or if they're attending something on a regular basis that is asking them to be inclined towards faith or others, and that is to take a journal. I take a journal to church, and I write down things that trigger those ideas that will then be open for deeper reflection. Or if I have something that bugs me, which, by the way, is so predictable because we always know the same things are going to be said,
yep.
Then it's like, oh, that's a piece for me to work on, because at this point I can work on de-triggering myself, as she mentions, so that I won't be so distressed about it. Even though I may experience the distress, I won't feel like it's a blank wall of hopelessness.
Yes. Oh, yeah. So good. Okay, and then this guy, that's a good feed for this last little bit that I think happens. And I don't think he talks about it in Stages of Faith. I should have reread the entire book, but I know it comes up in Faithful Change, the book that he had just published when I happened to meet him on the plane. There's this term called the scandal of the particular. I don't know if you guys have heard of that. It's this idea of that you get a sense when you start to get into those critical distancing stages, like stage 4, you say, what on earth was I thinking? How could my one little religion, you know, speak so highfalutin of itself? Why does something that's so particular pretend that it has universal truth that everybody must, you know, honor and whatnot? And he uses the example from the New Testament of, you know, can anything good come out of Nazareth? And, you know, and I don't know if all of us realize, Nazareth is like the smallest little, you don't even call it a town. It was just a region within, and it's like the lowest of low, and here's this, you know, your Messiah comes out of this. You know, another one is, you know, how odd of God to choose the Jews. You know, why would these people be the ones, would be this thing. And so I remember going through that with Mormonism myself. It's like, God, I'm, you know, through my dissertation, I said, you know, these things have things to offer. This is good stuff to think out of, even if it's just, you know, adding a new angle to the, you know, now a new instrument is now joining the string section or something. You know, it's worthy of my life to, you know, to think and love and look at these symbols again of mine and give them the fullest expression that they can. There's a great, you know, phrase from B.H. Roberts, you know, long longer fits with the earlier ways that things are presented. Give, you know, the symbols of the Restoration new life and new meaning. And that's been an important thing for me. So this stage five is kind of a regaining of confidence that our own tradition has a place in the world of truth and reality. We have deep wisdom that is not completely swallowed up by the crap that an organization pulls or that our culture does or something like that. There's this ability, and Fowler talks explicitly about it, of being able to really own, just, you know, how it's like, you know,
really
you hate your,
yeah,
you know, when you're so embarrassed by your own family, and then later on you just learn, oh, everybody's family is kind of crazy and weird and strange, and you kind of make peace with your
right.
family. It's the same thing with your religion. This is something that can happen if you've gone through this pulling apart stage. There can be a healing and something together. So,
well, in relationship stages, let's say long-term marriages that survive and then eventually thrive again, going through a lot of stuff, it's both the stage four and the stage five. Couples learn to like the peculiarities and quirks they once battled against. They can hold the whole person and love them enough that they see what they're projecting onto them, but they also don't get so upset about that, or they can laugh about it, and it combines to help them unite or be closer because they can pull all these quirks in and then integrate it. It's much like looking at a Picasso painting. You might not like him, but if there's one you do like, you'll notice he's torn everything apart, done it different ways, pulled it back together, and has created something.
Yeah, yeah. I haven't analyzed it at depth, but there's that song that's out there popular right now called All of Me Loves All of You. And there's the part of the chorus is, you know, I like your edges, something like that, and all your perfect imperfections. Or something. It was a little
something
bit
like that. Yeah.
That just reminded me there. But yeah, it's just like, you know. And I'll tell you, one of my favorite phrases that ever happened to me was when we first moved to Bountiful. It was when I was writing my dissertation. We were in a ward, and we were with this, and we actually lived in the same fourplex with this couple, and their name was Ed and Yvonne. And I can't remember if it was a Mother's Day talk. I know I've used it later on a Mother's Day talk that I gave. But this Ed said something in his testimony or just whatever. He talked about, I'm so grateful for Yvonne. And he didn't like say because of her qualities or attributes of being this great wife and whatnot. You know, he kind of explicitly says, I'm just glad that she's Yvonne, the fullness of Yvonne. You know what I mean? There was some way of phrasing that just like, okay, this guy gets it. You know,
we
don't want to just make the attributes what we celebrate and pedestalize it. It's like, I'll take the fullness of this woman that I love. And
I'll take all of it, yeah.
I loved it. So anyway, Katie, how you hanging?
Awesome. I am learning a whole bunch, so. Like both of your insights, I feel bad that I haven't really guided it too much, but it just seems to be just such an organic flow that I haven't wanted to interject. So, but this is really great.
All right, let's go to stage six. Stage six is so difficult, and Fowler admits, he goes, this is so hard to talk about. He had only mapped, I'm trying to find my chart again, I've kind of buried it here on my desk. He had mapped just a few percentage of people, less than 2% of the people in his 360 that he interviewed, did he put at stage six. He calls it universalizing. So universalizing faith. And he just talks about the difficulty of experiencing it because, you know, you have to live it. You have to be in it. But he gets a sense that there's some people that at some point they're able to so fully identify with what he calls being, you know, capital B being, or the universal will. You feel like you're so connected with life and everything it's trying to show you that you just naturally go with it. You naturally don't reject it. You simply act upon what it seems to be showing you. And I, maybe I shouldn't skip out of ahead of him, but I'm going to try to say something. People like Mother Teresa, people like Jesus Christ, people like Martin Luther King, these are among the people that he sort of senses maybe oriented at this stage of life. They're the people who, because the life has presented them something and they've felt something, they're so confident that they're in touch with, that they'll give their life fully, even dangerously, even recklessly, to serving, you know, the good out of the compassion. So Mother Teresa with the most difficult people to see God in, you know, for her to take her life and just to simply say, I see Christ in you. You know, her phrase, Christ in his distressing disguise. I love St. Benedict's phrase, you know, for the monastery when he first started, and it says, all are welcomed here as Christ.
Yeah, so it moves into that, your identity moves into the all of it, into everybody, into the whole world,
yeah.
And all sentient beings in Buddhist terms. So that, but try to describe it. Alan Watts has a great little phrase, which is, to try to describe it is like trying to F the ineffable.
Right, yes. Awesome.
Because you have to experience it. It's not, you can describe it, but you have to experience it.
Yeah, yeah. It's wild. And I think maybe it'll help us right there with what you just said. It'd be like, okay, I'm, you know, stage five, I'm feeling this and I recognize this and I'm feeling this connection with the universal will, or I really feel like I'm grounded in reality and things can't throw me. But here I act differently. This is like the married couple who are on a round the world trip, and they visit India, and somehow or other they are, you know, so moved by the children, the orphans or something, that they sell their house back in the States. They pick up and they move, and the rest of their life is oriented towards this thing. And guess what? Their family's back home going, you're missing your grandkids. You're missing the ball games. We're missing, you know, but they've so just sort of radicalized, you know, this powerful identification with what needs to be done in the world that they've begun to separate, like you said, Mary Beth, or something in your phrasing, I don't remember what it was, but you begin to detach from your primary social relations and you
your
move
identity
into,
moves
yeah,
into
yeah. You can love, you can love others as much as you love your own, you know, something. You're beginning to move in that direction, right?
So you don't, some people cut themselves off, but not necessarily. They can move back and forth between stages, like having a stick transmission that you can move at will back and forth, and
yeah.
You can, in a sense, you can still do grandparent time, but you then, you know, alternate it with some larger service time, or you can do it at home. So essentially, it's not negative in that sense, although there will be people who give up everything to do it, because we know about them, we tend to see them as saints, but we're not looking
right.
We don't know how to find a big enough cohort of people who are there to really describe it more fully. Talking
yeah.
Maslow, in all of this, if people are interested, go back and read Maslow, because he again moves into what it looks like at each stage personally, and this is what he, at the end of his life, started to describe as self-transcendence, meaning you integrate and include everything else before, but you're beyond the self. You're beyond the individual important ego. You're in the universal sense of self.
Yeah. Nice. So in Zen tradition, for instance, one of the metaphors is like polishing the mirror so that you're a full reflection of reality. And
mm-hmm.
and so, and then one of Fowler's, you know, examples here, he says like Jesus Christ, you know, we have these terms, or, you know, we put it into his word that he said, I'm the way, the truth, and the life. And again, we've done our little moves like, what does that mean? The way, the truth, and life. And we just begin to start thinking of them as titles and whatnot. But what Fowler kind of senses that he may have been saying is, look at, you know, just like earlier on when I think it's Philip asks him, you know, show us the Father. And he goes, well, you've seen me, you've seen the Father. In other words, I'm a perfect reflection of, you know, what God is like. So I'm the way, I'm the truth, I'm the life. Think about all those as simply statements. They're not titles. They're not honorifics. They're more like descriptives of, you know, I'm living this life that is this perfect reflection. But it's this idea, again, that he's not making these titles that, oh, we better honor the term that he is the life, you know, or right. Something like that. He's just basically talking, you know, matter-of-factly.
Right.
These are the kind of things here. In Taoism, you know, there's the sensitive here of, you know, the universal will you would call like the Tao, which is this thing. And so the Taoist master is one who does not act. You know, the phrase is they act without acting, but it basically means this person, he or she, does not act, but gets out of the way of this Tao and what it's, you know, kind of suggesting or whatever, and you flow. So you go with the flow. You know, again, I don't want to trivialize these with the way these phrases are, but there's a deep sort of sense of, you know, they call it Wu Wei within Taoism or something like that, of the most effective person is one who, you know, like in Tai Chi or something like that, where energy is coming at you, you use it, you know, instead of fight against it. You're not trying to impose your will on it. Hopefully that makes some kind of sense.
It makes some kind of sense, but it's really important to go back to that you're all sages, because when you're encountering people that really are at a different stage or the black and white confrontive stage, you can both allow it and you can also both enter the discourse at the same time. In other words, you can operate at two stages at once because you are everything or whatever, and so you can move back and forth, or you with it's so big and encompassing that you can move to another stage, but you still have all of the more developed stage. So it's very interesting way to look at it rather than moving back and forth, like you move up and down the ladder or in and out of the drinking cup. It's all of it. So you can operate in all stages.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Just a couple other images. So I don't know if it's from the book, but one last little phrase that I've picked up somewhere from Fowler, and I wrote it in the margins here of my book. It simply says that, you know, people who are in stage six, they've affirmed God so much, or they've affirmed being or the universal will so much, they become vibrant and powerful, you know, and they have a quality that just sort of, you know, resonates for us. But he says the way that they act, and here's the quote, their subversiveness makes our compromises show up for what they are. And so it's like your way of being, and it's like, oh, you mean you don't value fame or recognition or all the different things that, like, you know, somehow are deep motivations. They're no longer, they are for these people, and you just have to sit there and you have to, like, meet them face to face, and you go, holy smokes, you know, and there's an attractiveness to it, but there's a repulsion to it at the same time, because you know, you're caught up short in it. Like it says, they're subversiveness by them acting so, you know, in a way that you do recognize is, man, those are the people to admire. It makes us feel bad, but it can hopefully be a motivation too, and that's why to bring it up.
So I have a little anecdote for my father. My father was in a state presidency. When he was released from that, he was put in as assistant ward clerk in the ward. And somebody approached him and said, "How does it feel? Does this sort of feel like a come down?" And my father replied, "The pay is the same."
Nice. That's a wonder. Yeah, he got it, right? Yeah, and there's just something to that to be admired. So, again, we talked about stage five seeming like crazy talk. I can't even imagine it. The only way that I'm able to enter into it is through sometimes reading the lives of people, you know, who it seemed to me have kind of shifted to this more universalizing faith. And it feels attractive to me at the same time, you know, I'm so far from being willing to let go of of my own self-protection, my own ego and all that stuff, that I just hold it out there as, you know, maybe I can get there. Maybe I can live into it. In fact, I think, what was his age for this? Rare before age 60. Is what Fowler says. So it's a life well lived that you might begin to emerge there. But again, very few people probably do. But I hope it sounds attractive to everybody. you know, ultimately, just any of this. If we're in struggle, if we're in pain, if nothing else, this map is the map of the human journey. And in this case, you know, obviously there's cognitive journeys and there's emotional journeys and all sorts of stuff. But in terms of orienting towards life and just feeling and having a, you know, have it do its magic on you, I think that these are, this is a pretty fun and good map. It's a good story.
Great. It is.
Now, let me ask a question. I think we touched on this a little bit earlier, but what about this sense here that it's sort of hierarchical, or that it's, you know, that is there any point at which maybe there's a temptation to think of yourself as better than somebody else if you sort of map your own experience onto this and realize that you're at a, quote, higher stage than someone else? How big of a problem is that? And maybe what could be done to sort of reframe it so that it's not so much of one?
Well, given that we're so used to hierarchical thinking, then we move into that and say, and then when the, you know, the modernism, postmodernism deconstruction said, no, that's not the case. And so I'm going to go back to Wilbur's integration saying you can do both at the same time. However, he helped me out here because he said, in some cases, there really is a hierarchical structure, particularly in terms of moral reasoning and values, because some things are better than others. Something does have more cognitive complexity and awareness. Some actions really do benefit the greater whole while also benefiting yourself all the time. And some things are lower stage values in which you can hurt other people and hurt yourself. So he takes a fairly strong sense that even though you can do both at one time, there are some times when we really should honor the hierarchical, and other times we should honor the horizontal, the egalitarian, but we have more judgment, the more developed we are, that we have judgment when to step into which action item or valuing.
Yeah, yeah. And earlier you talked about the drinking cup, how, you know, that was an important metaphor that was this. And you also talked about Wilbur's term holarchy and holarchical,
right,
rather than there. That's based upon a term that he didn't invent, but he embraced. It's called holons. And his idea of a holon is that things are both whole and part at the same time, and you always recognize them, and that there's an important balance between wholeness and partness. So, for instance, you know, we need to be part of a group, you know, recognize that sort of things. But we also need to be individuative. And if you go too far one direction, you'll get swallowed up. And if you go too far the other one, you'll lose the connections that really give, you know, life-affirming stuff. And so I do think those are both good things. I'm with Wilbur a little bit, Mary Beth, on terms of, you know, some things are better and worse and more or less. And so, and all of us, we just need to own the fact that we're trying to persuade at all times and that we do make judgments. And, you know, you want to be careful with it. You want to be sensitive to it. But I think especially for folks that stage 5 and 6 have become a reality, there's not a lot of sense there. I know that when I was in stage 4 and when I was in the midst of the throes, and when I, the thing is, you know, about stage 4, we didn't really talk about when I was first getting, you know, my critiques of Mormonism and seeing it as one system among other systems. And I was beginning to do this. I was taking other people's authority. I thought I was shifting it to myself, and in some ways I was, because now I have multiple authorities that I'm listening to, but I kind of bought other people's interpretations for a while, and it was only a while later that I began to say, well, that's their interpretation too. You know, there's that moment that you kind of know that you're becoming an educated person, because when the first thing's presented, you now say, well, who wrote that?
Right.
Why did they write this? Where are they coming from? You know, what's their agenda? And you begin to see that. But at first you kind of uncritically just switch one authoritative figure for others, you know, and whatnot. So anyway, I'm trying to simply say is early on, I did think that I was better than those Mormons who just never thought outside the box. You know what I mean?
Which is a good illustration of where you were at that stage and how you, yeah.
Exactly. And now, again, I told the Randy story. I told the Tom story. And again, I hope Tom is not at all feeling like it. It's just like the journey, you know, farther down the road. I've seen a bit more. There's a great phrase from one of the essays I published by Stephen Carter. And he talks about his mom and him. And he goes, you know, she keeps wanting to talk about the sun, but I've also seen the aurora borealis.
Right.
You know, and in other words, I love the sun too, you know, and the sun's very, very important. But, you know, there's these other aspects that I struggle talking with my mom about, but it's not like I'm better than my mom or something. It's just I'm drawing on a deeper, a different well of experience where she certainly is frustrated, I'm sure, with him, that he doesn't see some things as,
right.
that she's had in-depth experience with as well. So I don't think it's a crippling critique.
No, it isn't. You're focusing on how we may critique or how we assess others. Let's bring it back to ourselves. One useful practice you can work with yourself is to notice what you get triggered by. And so write them down. What was upsetting? What was disappointing? What was even triggered by really positive? And then go back through and say, when I was triggered and my level of thinking, write down your stream of consciousness at that time and say, where was I? What stage did that get triggered in? What were the gifts of that, and what was my limitations? And how, so essentially, you work with an inner dialogue between different parts of yourself or different stages of consciousness with yourself. It becomes quite alive. You can have sort of an inner committee meeting. So you can use it for your own self-growth, and that actually moves you farther down the road because you become more compassionate about every stage within yourself and then at the same time with other people.
So is it maybe a difference, between recognizing, okay, this may or may not serve me, or this other person, I can observe that it's not serving them, you know, as well as it might, but I can also see ways that it does serve them. And so you can make those sorts of evaluations about it, but without necessarily the judgment or the implied superiority, you know, from my perspective, oh, I'm in four and I'm, you know, thinking about things that those other people aren't, kind of without the condescension, just more of the, oh, okay, you know, that's where they are and this is where I am, and I can, you know, have compassion for that, or I can, you know, I can appreciate the difference, and I can recognize things that maybe they're not
seeing. Right. There's another way to do this in terms of judgments of other people. So I'm moving from inner work now to outer work. Byron Katie, some of you may know, but if you go to her website, thework.com, she has sheets there about how you describe your judgments of other people and then how you turn it around and then use it as an introspective device to look to where those aspects are actually in you as well as in them.
Mm-hmm,
and she's a little rigid about it, saying all situations are that way, which I don't buy. But it's very helpful because it gives you structure for the work of doing this. And as you know, for learning a language or learning a physical skill, the structure or the discipline makes an enormous difference in being able to actually achieve it.
Katie, did you finish your question, or are you good on the hierarchy?
Yeah.
Okay. One thing I want to say, and it kind of maps a little bit like Mary Beth here, once you're at peace with yourself, then, you know, the judgment goes away from others. And there's a certain sense of, it was perfect for my journey to have gone this way because all those things have served me. And so there's kind of a peace that I have, no matter where somebody is nowadays. I kind of just want to say, you know, that's perfect for them. That's where their life is.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't have the same background as them. And, you know, when I look, and I guess I'm sure that Mary Beth has seen it more, and you'll see it a lot more, Katie, when some people have lived life, you know, with an abuse background or a neglect background, or, you know, they internalized things there, it's like remarkable sometimes that they're even functioning in this world in any kind of way. And we just need to honor that we don't know somebody else's story. We don't know who they are, and to think I'm better or worse, you know. And I think I've talked about, you know, I have been taught so much by my in-laws. My mother-in-law died a few years ago, but they loved me as their crazy son-in-law with all these crazy ideas. You know, they never thought anywhere close to, you know, the kind of pulling apart theoretical level. But they just lived their life in service and focus with other people, and I am nowhere close to as good a person, you know, as either of them are.
They would
you know, absolutely map at stage three without even probably even peaked too much at stage four, because they didn't have, I don't know. So I just look around at people like me and say, their life isn't my life. Their life's about something different than my life is. This is what my gifts are. This is what my journey has. And it's just hard to be, remain judgmental.
Okay. So let me break in here. They may live their life at stage three. However, if they really had that openness and non-judgmental and whatever, they may be infused with some higher stage understanding or feeling, but they don't identify with it. We wouldn't describe it. We may not describe it. But in fact, it's there. So some of those higher stages can come in down in through and really enliven that stage. So it's not a discrete stages.
Yeah,
it's
that's
much,
true.
It's much more, it's more like the colors moving from one to the other, or you can combine some colors and you get something else. It's really more vibrant like that.
And if we use some Wilbur language, he talks about levels and lines, and there's different lines of development. There's emotional development, intellectual development, physical development, spiritual development. He, you know, honors Fowler as kind of dealing with that line. And so, you know, let's say that we're really advanced intellectually, doesn't mean that we're advanced emotionally or, you know, in terms of empathy or something like that. And whereas, you know, if you were to have like the equalizer with the bars, you know, going up with the different levels of treble and bass and all that kind of stuff with everybody, there's lots going on versus this centering consciously within this new perspective. So hopefully that some people level this critique and it drives me crazy because they think it's this devastating thing. Oh, it's not politically correct, therefore we're not even going to touch it. You know, this idea of judgment. And for Fowler, you know, again, nobody here is presenting this as the absolute territory. It's just a map. I think it's a good map. I think it's a helpful map.
It's a good working theory, which doesn't mean it's the final truth.
Yeah.
Well, wow, we have had just a wonderful discussion. I have loved learning and got several more books I wrote down on my list now to read, so I really appreciate that. Maybe we can hang on for just a couple more minutes and share just some final thoughts or anything we didn't quite have a chance to get to, that we really wanted to bring up, if either of you have anything like that.
I do, in many ways, listeners, I'd love your feedback on this. There's one piece of developmental theory. It comes up a lot with Wilbur that Mary Beth and I have, so maybe I'll have her back on for a future podcast, but let me tease a little bit about this area. You know, individuals, this is kind of an individual thing here, but there's sort of a sense that groups go through and cultures through.
Mm-hmm.
Developmental levels and things like this too. And there's a piece of Fowler, it's in the very, I think it's the very final chapter of the book, where he talks about the modal developmental level of religious traditions.
Right.
And I'm going to go ahead and just give you a tease here with a quote. And then I think it's enough to build a whole show about. So Mary Beth, we'll see if you're willing to come back. But it says, the modal developmental level is the average expectable level of development for adults in a given community. In faith terms, it refers to the conscious or unconscious image of adult faith towards which the educational practices, religious celebrations, and patterns of governance in a community all aim. The modal level operates as a kind of magnet in religious communities. Patterns of nurture prepare children and youth to grow up to the modal level, but not beyond it. The operation of the modal level in a community sets an effective limit on the ongoing process of growth in faith. And so there's this idea of, you know, any organization, any community kind of says, this is where you should be. And it's pretty easy to kind of get up to that level. But then there's this, it can kind of hinder you breaking away when you want to explore beyond that level. And so there's this important dynamic here. But lest Mormons think that they're the worst of all, he basically argues that every religion centers pretty much at stage three, type of things, you know, you can tell why the external authorities, you know, faith in the prophets, the leaders, the scriptures, etc., rather than yourself. You'd see that that's why any organization would do that and things like this. And so he says, while every group centers in stage three as a community, as an organization, as sort of just this invisible force, every one of them has teachings that point you to stage six.
Right, exactly.
That say, this is the full expression. This is the deep wisdom of our religion. We have things in our scriptures, in our theology, that are absolutely stage six, and they say this is fully part of Mormonism. To try to become like God, guess what? That's stage six. You know, and yet it seems like the average education level, the things that we point children to, all those different things, is to grow up to be fully functional stage three people. And so we have to recognize that there's these dynamic forces going on. So I'd love to do a whole show on that, but I wanted to alert people to it at this point.
Right.
Mary Beth?
I would just add on or support what you're saying. And one of the things I think that has helped within Mormonism and probably other religions is that when you start to move into stage four or beyond, the advent into the internet and chat groups and blogs and places where you can explore but still affirm if you want to stay active, or you can still affirm parts of your life, you would develop a multimodal life. I'm thinking at the moment of Feminist Mormon Housewives. And so that is now such a gift that wasn't available before the advent of the internet and the whole social media movement. And so I think it's delightful, even though at times it's chaotic, even though there's backlash, even though there's, you know, there's just so many openings now that I think we, even as a culture, can become a multimodal culture. Because we know each other, we contact each other.
That is such. That's what's going on for sure.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Well, thanks, Katie. Go ahead and finish up.
Mary Beth, do you have any final thoughts that you'd like to share with us today?
It's kind of where I came in, which is to say this developmental stage theory and looking at multiple theories, applying to where I am in my life, and then particularly looking at clients and where they are and helping resolve some of their distress, because they're two parts of the self that are in different developmental stages, and try to ease those transitions, because I know how it happens in real life or within myself or in developmental theory about how you ease transitions. It's been enormously useful. However, when you bring this up at a dinner party, it's the quickest way to get deafening silence. Because you have to, in yourself, be interested in it and be interested in academic learning in this area. And so, you know, there's a small cast of characters who just find themselves enlivened by it, and I happen to be one of those. Anyway, thank you so much for inviting me to this forum.
Well, thank you so much for being here. And thank you, Dan, for allowing me the opportunity to participate in this discussion. It's been wonderful. Thank you for sharing your knowledge and your expertise with us. One thing that I want to put in a plug for all the listeners is to be sure to donate to Mormon Matters. This is something that I know helps Dan out a lot, and I personally make a donation every single month. And, you know, it's something because I value Mormon Matters a lot. It's something that means a lot to me and has helped me and continues to help me along my spiritual journey, and I would invite other people, if they likewise find Mormon Matters to be helpful, to show Dan some love through the PayPal.
Love through the PayPal. Thank you. I didn't expect you to do that pitch, but appreciate it. It does mean a lot. It means a ton to be able to do this work that I love, but you know, it allows me to not have a 9-to-5 job. So thank you very much.
And if you have any questions or comments, as Dan always says, remember to go check it out at MormonMatters.org and comment on the blog. And I'm guessing, Dan, that you'll be there to answer questions or respond back to comments or concerns or feedback or whatever. And Mary Beth, we hope too that you would, you know, that you'll be there as well if there are any questions that pop up or anything like that that your expertise could be useful on.
Thanks. I'll alert you, Mary Beth, when I see stuff that's directed
great.
To
that
you.
Would be helpful.
Thanks, Katie. Thank you again, my friend. Both of you.
Thank you. It's been great. Cue the music.
Thank you for joining us today on Mormon Matters Podcast. To discuss this podcast with others, please check us out at mormonmatters.org. To keep this podcast alive, or to join our support community, please consider a tax-deductible donation today at mormonmatters.org. Music for this podcast was brought to you by Brittany and Clayton Pixton. The Mormon Matters logo was generously provided by StudioCase.com. Thank you for listening.
All is well.